Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much do brands matter in your life? Even if you're not the sort of consumer who buys things with an eye toward impressing those around you, just about everything you spend money on is tied to some sort of brand. And like it or not, those brands communicate messages not only about particular products and services, but about the people who consume them. So is that such a bad thing? Well, it can be, my guest today would argue, when the brand and its reputation become even more important than the quality of the products they represent. Take, for example, the city of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Concerned about the area's bad reputation for crime, public funds were spent on rebranding efforts designed to take the emphasis off crime, funds that might have been spent directly on reducing that crime itself. Lucas Conley is a contributing writer to Fast Company magazine. His new book is called Obsessive Branding Disorder, The Illusion of Business and the Business of Illusion. Lucas, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You write, branding has devolved into a disorder that corrodes the nature of identity. Can you talk about that?
Sure. When you look at how brands are approaching us now today in the modern media, it's less about what we may need or what consumers' needs are, and more about attracting and romancing our emotions. And this gets more into our identity than it does our everyday needs. So, for instance, when you look at a cleaning product in the kitchen, something that may have just been used or advertised for its powerful antibacterial ingredients years ago, now is advertised for its smells, for its design, for its appeal to a sense of community. Are you this type of consumer, and what kind of person are you? So brands are beginning to recognize that emotions are faster selling points than actual rational needs.
Do they have the ability to symbolize anything meaningful?
Sure. And you can take an example from an everyday household brand like Kleenex. This is kind of a good example because you would never assume that pulp paper would have a very good means of getting into emotion or identity. But when you look at the private label products that are kind of approaching brands from the generic perspective, and really generic products have gotten very good in the past 10 years, Kleenex has to do better. They have to attract consumers in a way that will make them want to buy the Kleenex brand instead of the other brand that's 30 cents or a dollar cheaper. So for Kleenex, they developed a campaign called Let It Out. And this is an emotional kind of appeal wherein they appeal to consumers to cry about their emotions. Be they something like a wedding or a death or just something they feel personally about themselves. And they set up these blue couches around the country, and they tape the performances. And they've even made a documentary that will air during the Olympics about Let It Out and the whole campaign. But the idea is, you know, hey, we're just tissue. We have nothing else really to appeal to you unless we dig into the emotional side of what our product can offer. So it's kind of a stretch, but it's where a commodity must go.
Well, and I think what's so interesting about that campaign, Lucas, is that you could sort of appreciate the sentiment of all that and the idea of crying over what makes you cry and still go to the store and look and say, okay, well, the store brand is 40 cents cheaper. But people actually do respond because they have that link in their mind, and somehow they think the additional 40 cents is worth it.
Sure. And that's another angle here. It's just getting in front of consumers in this, what they like to call the attention economy, is any way we can make folks remember us to kind of stand out. And, you know, when you're walking down the tissue aisle or the toilet paper and paper towel aisle, you're looking at 8 feet by 100 feet of paper. And there's really not a lot differentiating each product to product except for the logo on the front and maybe some personal experience you've had with each of these products. And when it gets to a point where they're very similar, something like a good jingle or maybe a funny ad, or in this case, an actual emotional campaign that hopes to kind of link into your mind, that's one step above the generic brand right next to the brand name.
So we all know that, you know, Kleenex and handbags and clothing and sneakers are branded, but can you help us get a handle on how virtually everything we do now can be tied to a brand?
Absolutely, and this is kind of where the book started. I was working at Fast Company magazine on staff at the time, reviewing books, and the books would come in about 3 to 5 a day, and I'd say about 1 to 2 branding books a week were coming in. And at first, they're fairly self-explanatory, how to brand your company, how to work on your brand, but they got pretty silly. Sensory branding, cult branding, all these types of primal branding and tribal branding, very, very branded ideas of branding. And as I began to look at those, I realized, you know, this is an industry that's It's expanding into every industry and beyond into pop culture. People now like to think of themselves as brands, and you'll find plenty of personal branding experts in everything from high rises to strip malls, waiting to help you with your brand. And beyond that, we're seeing not only everything being branded, but you look everywhere. Brands are popping up in very strange places, like doctors' table paper, the paper they pull over their examination tables now have advertisements. I spotted an advertisement in the Tupperware tub that I put my laptop computer in at the airport the other day. Steamboat Springs, the ski resort up in Colorado, has branded it the snow that falls on its 600 acres or however many acres of its ski resort. So if you step 1 foot in Steamboat Springs and hold out your arm, you're watching champagne powder fall into your hand. And if you hold out your arm on the other side, you're just looking at snow.
Lucas Conley is my guest. His new book is called Obsessive Branding Disorder, The Illusion of Business and the Business of Illusion. You know, you talk about the personal brand thing. And you know, Tom Peters was the one who wrote about that first, I guess, in your magazine, in Fast Company. This idea that every person is a brand, how is that playing itself out in the job market and the way people sort of move through the world?
I think the real appeal of a personal brand now is a little different than it was back in the late 90s or mid-90s when it started to get popular, popularized largely by Tom Peters and the brand called You on that cover of Fast Company in 97. And I think at that point it was very much about breaking out on your own, leaving the company, the corporate world, and starting your own .com or starting an entrepreneurial life and really realizing who you were. And there was some authenticity to that. I mean, really kind of recognizing that you were different than the manager track at your Fortune 500 company, and you wanted to do your own thing. And I think as the market turned and as people got tired of the idea of personal branding from that kind of buzzword angle, personal branding became a little more utilitarian to what it is now, which is very focused on differentiating yourself inside your company, such that if you move every 2 years, like a lot of people do now from company to company, you have a recognizable identity as a personal accountant, for instance, that's different from the other 10,000 personal accountants that have the exact same job description. So a lot of personal branders will work on accenting your career and your resume in a certain way that makes you look and look different and differentiate you from your colleagues.
Well, one thing that's interesting is you say it makes you look different from your colleagues. There are many examples, and you have found them, where the brand ultimately becomes much more important than whatever it stands for, where you have, you know, magazines being formed before the brand is formed, before anybody thinks about what they would contain, the sort of content that would be in them.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the major flaws in business right now, and that's why I call it an obsessive disorder, is that rather than thinking of a brand as something that comes from the bottom up, defined by consumers, defined by your products and your services and kind of the ghost in the machine, if you will, realized from all the things that you do, a lot of executives now, and especially branding gurus who kind of spin this in books and lecture tours, will talk about branding as a top-down type of idea where you can turn your brand into something it's not, or you can over a weekend workshop and a major overhaul of your logo change your brand. And I think consumers are smarter than that, and a lot of times we can see through that, and it looks silly. For instance, the singular to AT&T, the singular kind of branding switches that cost millions of dollars, you know, $100 million every switch, is a huge waste of money. But we can see through that. It's when brands are thinking about top-down branding in a way that's trying to get past our mental filters that you start to see some of the more troubling stuff.
Well, you know, you mentioned that we can see through a lot of it. I'm wondering what relationship branding and its overwhelming nature these days has to consumer trust.
I think it's a downward spiral, and I think most consumers will probably agree with that on some level. If you look at the surveys, the level of consumer satisfaction and the level of expectations has an interesting correlation. Over the past several years, our expectations of brands, the promises that they give us and these ideas that brands are going to deliver, this kind of halo around a brand like Apple, for instance, our expectations get higher and higher. But when you look at the actual customer satisfaction rates across the board, they're getting lower. So there's this kind of growing gap between the two of what we believe and hope for from products and brands, and what we ultimately feel in the end.
And yet, consumers certainly do sort of use brands as a kind of shorthand to understand what they might expect from a product. I mean, we're not only walking around thinking, "Oh, I wish they would leave me alone." Sometimes you look at a brand when you're surrounded by things that you don't recognize, and we sort of allow ourselves to take information from those brands.
Sure, it is kind of a language, isn't it? At this point, the way we discuss brands and the way we kind of exchange brands, especially now that we're increasingly global in our dialogue with other countries and our understanding of brands is becoming unified, it's no longer necessarily the American brands that we talk about. It's new brands coming out of Asia. It's new brands, media brands coming out of Europe. And we could transfer a lot of information with that simple little trap door that is a brand. This is you know, after all, how the idea of a brand evolved through human nature is that you use one word or a couple words to unlock a very complicated idea or a series of experiences and products and services with a company.
What's at work when a big company, I'm going to give the example of Target here because I'm well familiar with their products. They've got several in-house brands, let's say of clothing, most of which are exclusive to Target itself, and they're sort of competing with each other under the same umbrella.
It's interesting, and the retailers have played a very interesting role in what I call obsessive branding disorder in the past decade or so. If you look at Target and the clothes they produce, my wife's a big fan, actually. We always stop there first when we walk in. They've got all the women's clothes set up right by the front door.
They're not stupid over there.
Our local Target. She knows, and they're great fashions, and they get really good designers. You know, Isaac Mizrahi, I think is his name, mm-hmm. was in there recently, and just very smart design is kind of their route, and inexpensive. And the problem for a more traditional brand in a store like Target there is that if you have Target, you know, sub-brands of Target brands competing for consumers' attention and then competing against your brand, you need to prove yourself. And the Target buyers, those folks who supply the products to the stores, will tell brands that this is an imperative. They'll come to brands like if you look at potato chips or ibuprofen or any aisle of the grocery store where you can have a brand that can be somewhat replicated, the Target buyers will step up to those brands like Lay's and Advil and say, listen, you know, if our product's going to outsell your product, if our good of the good, better, best is outselling you at the top end, there's no reason for you to be in our shelf. So you need to either rebrand your product, put it in a new package, give us a new formula. You need to do something to attract consumers' attention. And brands have begun to call this feeding the monster. And that's one of the branding firm's kind of terms for dealing with the outrageous pace of cycles at Target and Walmart and these big retailers.
Yeah, and in some cases, the store brands now are not as inexpensive. They are more expensive than the branded item that originated the whole thing.
Oh, and you know you're in trouble when your brand, which really only exists, right, to offer a higher selling point, if you're in a commodity product industry, if your brand's being outsold by the private label goods, and especially if they're charging more.
Lucas Conley is my guest. He is a journalist and a contributor to Fast Company magazine. His book is called Obsessive Branding Disorder, The Illusion of Business and the Business of Illusion. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. We'd love for you to join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. With us for the hour is journalist Lucas Conley. His new book is called Obsessive Branding Disorder, The Illusion of Business and the Business of Illusion. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. You know, it strikes me, Lucas, that the brilliance of the store brand versus, you know, traditional brand model is that the store brands actually benefit from all the work that the traditional brands are doing to promote their own products.
Absolutely. And you know what's funny is I was walking in a grocery store just yesterday and noticed that the placement on the shelves, I mean, this is obviously something that, brands care very much about, and for anybody who knows anything about how stores consider where brands are placed in the, on the shelves, it's a very big deal, and there's a lot of calculus that goes into and a lot of money that goes into where brands appear as you walk down the aisle. But the placement on those shelves, it's automatically to the advantage of a retail outlet when they can place their brands in particular spots they understand are overlooked by mainstream brands or are given more attention by consumers, whether that's an end cap at the end of an aisle or at a, just at a certain spot right on the left or right as you enter an aisle. They, these stores understand that environment much better than the brands who kind of have to purchase that space from them. And they can use the lessons that brands have learned over the past several decades, just in that one small example, to kind of guide consumers to their, you know, lower-priced goods.
One thing that I think is really fascinating that comes up in the book is how branding affects the life cycle of a particular product. It is, the turnover is extraordinary.
It is, and I think everybody has a personal story at this point of a product that they've liked, maybe a service at a particular company that has been discontinued, and you have to either find the new scent or the new flavor, or it's you got to go to a whole new brand. A lot of times this happens because you have a, you know, a major brand like a Neutrogena or something with a very recognizable name, and then sales start to taper off, and as a new upstart brand like Method Soap might come along with a new bottle and a great look, somebody like Neutrogena has to stop and say, okay, what can we do to kind of bring attention back to our product? Well, that means, you know, launch a new face mask, and that means a new major spokesperson and get the buyers on board to kind of get us the right space in the store. The result is you see these branding firms, and I visited many of them in Cincinnati, where most of them are a lot of them are based around Procter & Gamble, which is the biggest branding company in the world. You see these branding firms almost turning down work. In several cases, they were turning down work because they simply said, this is too fast. You know, we can't put out 15 new Swiffer brands in the next 3 years. We just it's just not interesting to us. Or maybe it betrays the brand. If you look at something like Pure Water Filters, there was a branding firm down in Cincinnati that was approached to develop a flavored pitcher that would deliver different flavored waters as you press these different buttons on top of the water pitcher. And the branding firm said, this isn't even the brand. Pure Water is about clean, crystal clear water, not Kool-Aid. You need a new brand to do this. So you can see, even as a result of turning down work, the question still exists, should there be more brands? Should there be less brands? It's a debate going on in the branding world right now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hey, Chris. Has your guest experienced anything I guess I'm just calling it some brand backlash, where, you know, I consciously rebel against consumer brands and such, first because usually the quality isn't what the hype, you know, they claim the hype to be, and secondly just because I think they're trying to control me. But is there a movement afoot or a phenomenon of brand backlash?
Hold on one second, because that's a great question, John, and I want to get Lucas's answer. I have to ask you, how do you buy things that have no brand?
Well, I'm kind of the anti-consumer. I don't buy a lot to begin with. You know, I guess, you know, I have a car, but it's not because it's a certain brand. It's because it was a used car that got good mileage, you know, that type of thing. I'm very utilitarian in my purchases. And I almost see that the more something is marketed or hyped, there's an inverse quality relationship to it many times, or the margins that they're getting from them are so great that it's not worth, you know, my time to purchase it.
Sure. All right. Thank you so much for your call, John.
Sure.
Lucas, what about the backlash question?
I definitely think there is. I think it's you've seen it for years in the shape of folks like Naomi Klein with her no logo
Which is ironically sort of a brand of its own at this point.
Right. Well, and of course, you look at similar media outlets like Adbusters, and you have to recognize that, yes, these are brands. And Naomi Klein has said that, quote, in spite of itself, the logo has become a brand, and Adbusters has run advertisements. So there's always been, or at least in the past, in recent history, as brands have expanded and media has allowed more and more routes to advertise, you've seen kind of a growing kind of distaste for the range of branding that we get in our lifestyle, in our consumer lives. And I think that if you look at the statistics, there's one that really makes sense and kind of draws things into the picture, which is that every year, something like 75,000 new food and beverage products hit the shelves, and something like 90% of our needs of the average consumer, and this is from an actual study, are usually met by about 200 products. So 75,000 new products assaulting us—that's just products on the shelves. That's not counting, you know, the amount of advertising that comes at us from all the different media. There's a sense that you know, if you look at The Paradox of Choice, is a book that's out there that's kind of explores this idea. When we're inundated with more and more products, it's harder to make a decision, and we feel overwhelmed. And especially when it's, you know, when you're talking about the advertising, we feel assaulted.
So one of the backlash responses to advertising is, at least from the perspective of brand people, is product placement, trying to get their products out there without making it really obvious. How pervasive is this now?
Product placement, it's an interesting topic because just last week the FCC announced that it was going to take a closer look at this. It's growing fast, and I think that, you know, the trend here is that, you know, back in 1965, you could place a television ad on one of the major three networks during prime time, and you'd reach, you'd reach most of the consumers. If you hit all three networks, you've got 90% of American women there. So when you look at what advertisers deal with now, you can understand why they're looking for ways to get to us that either might get past our mental filters or that might just simply get past our TiVo. When we're blocking out ads, why not put the advertisement actually in the program itself? And, of course, the problem here is that advertisers aren't going to draw the line when it comes to personal ethics. When you look at the history of advertising, there's always somebody willing to push it a little further. So when you look at the way product placement is expanding now, the stat that I loved that I heard recently was that the leading show for product placement this past season, in the January through April quarter, was The Biggest Loser, and the weight loss show, reality show, and it had every 5 seconds there was a new product placement.
It's pretty amazing that there is so much of it out there. Can you talk about, I know the EU has some regulations about how consumers will at least be notified that product placement exists. Can you talk about that?
Sure, and that's interesting because I think that has put a little bit of heat on the U.S. to start looking at the issue. Product placements are banned in the UK right now, and the minister in charge of media over there has publicly stated that he's absolutely not interested in ever lifting that ban, which has got advertisers kind of anxious to get their products into programs in the United Kingdom. But over in Europe, with the EU, they have a slightly different set of regulations that also also applies to some degree to the UK, where the product placements must be mentioned. And I think this actually is rolling out as we speak, fully effective by 2010, I believe, so that if you put a product placement in a program, no matter how small, you have to disclose this before the program, at each commercial break, and then afterwards. And they've also said that, you know, we can't have product placements in news or current affairs or children's programs. Now, that, you know, the regulations over here are still somewhat soft in those areas. There was a piece on Entertainment Tonight recently, created within the studio, done with the Entertainment Tonight staff reporters. Real stars took place and were interviewed, and it was all a big ad for Wishbone dressing. So you can see that current events, for instance, is something that is still perfectly open field, open game for advertisers and product placements here in the U.S.
It's hard to believe that that would actually be successful in selling wishbone dressing, but I guess it must work.
You know, if people are willing to sit there for the 2 minutes and listen to, I think it was Melissa Joan Hart, I can't remember her name, but talk about why she loves, you know, wishbone dressing because it helps her lose weight after her pregnancy. You know, it's better than the 30-second ad that they get up and walk away from.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Kristen in Dallas. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. I was wondering if you could speak. Well, let me start off with, I think a lot of people know that often a house brand is produced by a name brand producer. You know, the Kroger brand is produced by, you know, in whatever product by somebody else that's a name brand, quote unquote. And so I was wondering if your guest could talk a little more about the conspicuous recruiting of a brand name like JCPenney, kind of very high profile way, recruiting Ralph Lauren to produce American Living for them, and Isaac Mizrahi being recruited by Target to produce what essentially is a house brand for them. And that relationship to kind of, especially now, the way the economy is going, what that relationship kind of is.
Sure. I think there's an interesting tension, and thank you for that question, because it's an issue that doesn't really have a resolution right now. I think a lot of the branding trends are headed in one direction or another, and I think this is something that's kind of undecided in the branding world right now, and that's the power of retailers to bring us low prices and to cut the cost of brands and basically kind of cut their cool so that we can get them at a cheap price point. But then the power of brands to kind of command a better price than maybe even the exact same product that they may be supplying to a grocery store. Tylenol recently ran ads saying, "We don't make store brand Tylenol," with the kind of almost a little bit of an imposing kind of fear-mongering attitude of, you know, don't trust store brand products because we're the name brand and we can guarantee our name brand. But when you look at designers coming into department stores like an Isaac Mizrahi or Ralph Lauren at JCPenney or some of these, it's kind of a trend recently for these bigger store department stores to bring in recognizable brands and kind of partner with them. The question is, you know, whose brand is being diluted? Whose brand is being lifted? You know, when Levi's steps into a Walmart and develops a whole new line for Walmart at a $25 price point for a pair of jeans, you begin to see, you know, cheaper jeans from Levi's, and you might expect better jeans from them. So it's definitely stretching brands into new areas. It's kind of challenging consumers' ideas of what a brand means and why it's important. Because if quality is challenged and quality is sacrificed, if only to offer more retailing options, then what is the brand after all? But just a logo.
Well, and what's so interesting on things like, particularly in fashion, it's not only a question of quality, because it's also a question of, at a certain point, a certain sort of person at a certain income level wearing an identical item to what someone, you know, paid $700 for 2 years ago, changes the cachet of the product and sort of keeps the cycle moving.
Yeah, well, the status. I mean, this is mm-hmm. the question of the status of the product. And that's, you know, it's fascinating when you see very, very high status brands knocked off, like a Louis Vuitton or a Gucci, and yet they maintain their status. When you see these counterfeit products just kind of flooding the streets of major cities in the U.S. and really around the world, even over in Asia, it's interesting to me that the brand's cachet, that cool factor that they have, that status that they can deliver to people in the affluent classes, still remains, even though anybody can get a look-alike bag at the, you know, 1/100th of the price.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Trey in Dallas. Hi, Trey.
Hi. I had a kind of a mixed question. Maybe it's two questions in one. I had to go back to the house brands versus name brands. And you made mention of that some house brands are now selling at a higher price than some of the house brands that they're competing with. And I was wondering if that's just something where they started bumping the price up and noticed that their sales weren't dropping off, and then finally they just passed the brand's price point. And do people just not pay attention to the actual price anymore? They just assume that it's cheaper? Or kind of a side question along with that is I've seen it be one of those people who and some of my friends have commented on that, that advertising, I mean, branding doesn't really mean a whole lot to me. So, you know, like a high, like a cool factor brand or anything like that doesn't really, I don't care. As long as it's well made and not real expensive. Is there, along with those lines, I guess the quality of a product, is usually more important to me. And, I guess that has to do with,
I think we've sort of got the tide of your question. Let's go ahead and give Lucas a chance to start answering. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for your question. I think I have an idea where you're going with this. To answer the first part, to talk about house brands and their kind of rising quality, the first example that comes to mind for me is if you walk into a Home Depot now, they have a couple lines. I think it's Behr Paints, that's the right name, and they have various lines of things like ceiling fans and outdoor furniture that over time consumers have recognized are a very good quality. And in many cases, are likely produced by name brands at a wholesale price, and then rebranded with Home Depot's label. Or I think the majority of the cases is when they're brought over from Asia from manufacturing facilities over there that can produce, you know, almost as good a lawnmower, almost as good a ceiling fan, and they can stamp the Home Depot labels, the Home Depot sub brands on those products. Now you can bring in a very discount product, something that may not last as long, something that may not be as good quality, and you can sell that at a very low price point. And Home Depot actually looks better with their house brands. They're offering you a really good product at a great price. They've got somebody even lower on the scale to kind of compare to, and you can say, you know what, this, you know, Home Depot sure brings me the goods. To answer, kind of get into your. Okay, that sounds like we're coming up on the commercial break.
We are. Thank you for noticing. Yes. We'll be back in just a minute with Lucas Conley. We'll get the sort of second part of that question that was asked. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or shoot an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm speaking this hour with journalist Lucas Conley, whose new book is called Obsessive Branding Disorder, The Illusion of Business and the Business of Illusion. And before the break, Lucas, you were responding to the caller who had said he feels pretty much impervious to influence by brands.
And that's, you know, I think that's a common sentiment, and I feel the same way myself. Often looking at the landscape of brands and branding, I feel as if I make my decisions. I choose which products I like and which I don't. And if they don't perform up to my expectations, I move on to a different brand. And I think the book responds to concerns or that type of reader when you get into the chapters on where brands are going to better understand consumers like us. Brands understand that it's difficult to pitch a jingle or to play a 30-second ad and win somebody over. Especially in today's landscape, when you can go online and kind of check out products ahead of time and read customer reviews, and you have a lot of information in your hands. And a lot of writers right now are kind of writing books about the death of brands and how brands are fading. And I think that that's absolutely wrong. I think when you look at what brands are doing to combat this trend, you see some very interesting work being done in the field of brain scan research, in the field of neuromarketing, as it's called. You see some very interesting work in terms of data collection, in terms of how brands are collecting information about us. To give you an example, when I started the book, one of the more interesting companies out there to me was a company called MobileTrack, and they had sensors set up around Washington, D.C. and in the parking lots of certain malls that could sniff, as they called it, the radio signal coming off your car. Now, they couldn't identify who you were. It was very anonymous, but they could sniff every single car that went by, and they could say that all morning, you know, the 60% of the listeners at this intersection were listening to this radio station. And they could provide that information to brands, and brands could advertise their products exactly on those stations. Now, 2 years later, the company that's kind of leading in this field that kind of represents how far the research that brands are doing has come is a company called True Media. And they've developed face reading technology that can be hooked up to a billboard. And now this billboard, and they're in markets all over the country, will assess how long you looked at the billboard, what your age and gender was, and soon what your ethnicity was. So they can break down all that information and say, you know, white guys in their 40s who drove by this billboard at 9 a.m. didn't pay attention to it at all, but they did over here at this other intersection on their drive home. So this understanding of what consumers think about, how we shop, what we pay attention to, there's a renaissance for brands right now in terms of their ability to understand that.
I think of all the things that you mentioned in the book, the one that chilled me the most was the one that at the outset I assumed I would have no problem with, and that is word of mouth marketing and advertising. There are lots of people who trust a friend or a neighbor or relative who mentions a product. There are a growing number of people who are being compensated to sort of push these products on people they know.
It's a fascinating field, and I'm surprised it took us this long to start seeing companies formalize their approach to word of mouth. And for folks who are unfamiliar with it, I mean, if you think about word of mouth as a concept, it's something we've used as long as we've had language. It's in our human nature to talk to each other about the products we like and the services and just the companies and malls and stores that we enjoy. I mean, we pass that information along, and it's really how I think some of the studies show, like 90% of us trust that information the most out of any kind of advertising or data that we pick up about brands. Now, recently, in the past decade, brands have started to kind of explore the field of word of mouth and kind of trying to understand how they can kind of push and pull the triggers that make us talk about products. And the result has been a series of very formal programs that have cropped up. The two most notable are at Procter & Gamble called Vocal Point and Tremor, and they focus on mothers and teens. And there's about 850,000 members in all, which amounts to about 7% of U.S. mothers and about 1% of U.S. teens. And they send out information to these folks, and they're specifically recruited to be very social people who have broad networks and talk to a lot of people at work or in their social lives. And they'll send them coupons, free samples, packets of information. And it's not just Procter & Gamble's soaps and crackers and things like that. It's products from Coca-Cola. It's information about Toyotas. It's information about new record albums. It's, you know, any brand can approach a Procter & Gamble, and they'll basically pimp out these 850,000 consumers to kind of spread the word of mouth. And what you said about the kind of chilling aspect here is that Procter & Gamble has kind of gone in the face of the advertising and marketing world against the current and said that we're not going to obligate our word-of-mouth teams to reveal that they're affiliated with us. They feel that that's not necessary. And there's even a word-of-mouth marketing association that has developed that says, you know, this is not good. We should be able to trust everybody that we talk to about products to reveal that they're working for a certain company or that they're just speaking on behalf of a certain company. And that's, you know, P&G has kind of created a bit of a stir in the field by deciding not to go in that direction.
Well, and even when we do it, when we share photos on Shutterfly or Kodak.com, that's word-of-mouth marketing, basically, because our friends can't see this unless they also sign up for the site.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, when you look at how brands are kind of recognizing new ways to kind of capture this, there are little, little tolls, little experience tolls where they can kind of set up a booth, you know, like a sign-in password at Kodak. So you can share your photos, but, you know, Kodak gets your sign-in information. Or, you know, when you look at these virtual online communities like Facebook and MySpace, you know, they're fantastic tools with all sorts of implications for the way we form our communities. But, you know, every 2 inches on the screen, there's another ad.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go out next to Kapel and speak with Brenda. Hey, Brenda.
Hi. I've got just a question for your guest. Brands, I'm talking about service brands, where companies buy a big companies, and they change the name. Do you think they do that because they're coming in with a product where the service is not going to be as good? And I'm talking about companies like phone companies and utility companies where we've seen a lot of mergers and a lot of things like that. So I just wanted to know what his thought was about that.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for the question. There's an interesting example just recently that may kind of shed some light on that one, and that's the Sharper Image. A lot of listeners will be familiar with the Sharper Image. It's a kind of a tech retailer that was famous for coming up with Ionic Breeze air cleaners and you know, everything from remote control cars to crystal lighting implements for your house. Very, you know, goofy, fun kind of mostly, let's say, irrelevant tech purchases, gadgets. And they kind of had a good run there for about 15 years. And in the last few years, they've had a real hard time selling these products. And they went bankrupt recently, and a group of investors came in and bought the name. They didn't buy the retail location so much or really the idea of continuing this retail brand, but they bought the name because of the inherent value and the recognition value of Sharper Image to so many consumers from so many years. And their idea now is that they'll get rid of these retail locations. They'll stop trying to sell other people's products and kind of have their own customer or their own employee core, and they'll just simply make computers with a Sharper Image brand on it, or make cameras with a Sharper Image brand, simply because they believe that the brand is recognizable enough and useful enough to them that consumers will look for it and pick it up. And I think that kind of leads to the idea that a lot of brands, whether they're useful to consumers anymore at all, are bought simply for the name recognition, or they're dumped because the name recognition is now saddled with bad news. You know, whether it's WorldCom or it's Enron or it's any of these brands that had to dissolve and reform under a very, you know, very similar geographical and employee and you know, a business constraints, but ultimately are very similar companies or products, but simply a new brand is cast over the service.
Like Philip Morris and Altria.
Yeah, absolutely. You look at Philip Morris and you think cigarettes, but you look at Altria, and most people see a kind of a color patchwork brand and don't think much about it. And maybe they think of Kraft or maybe they think of cigarettes, but it takes a while for that brand to kind of sink into the public consciousness.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line is Adam in Dallas. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know you don't have much time left, so I'll make it quick. I was wondering if your guest could discuss the effects on consumer choice when the brand name just becomes the name of the product. You know, like MP3 players are all iPods, and all soda in Texas is Coke. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. That's a great question. And it's a question that the lawyers really love to get into because you talk about, I think they call it the genericizing or the kind of I forget what the actual term is for this, but when you look at something like Kleenex, for instance, when enough people, when your brand is so big and so strong that people just simply start saying Kleenex or linoleum or any number of these other products that have become so synonymous with what they are, that they lose their trademark. And this has happened in a number of cases where brands have not protected their trademark well enough, and courts have said, okay, you know what? It's been out there so long, people use this, it's ubiquitous, that you've lost your ownership of the brand name. And millions and millions, I mean, I'm sure maybe billions are spent every year in patent lawsuits these days, whether it's simply in the software industry for actual integrity of the invention, or it's just the trademark world where you're trying to protect a name. And yes, you'll see brands protect their names very, very vehemently. You'll see a tissue brand Kleenex or Kleenex brand tissues with a big trademark symbol, because they know that if they don't put that there, you risk losing the kind of authentic or the differentiation. And you see that even with new products out there now, like Google. When people talk about Googling something, Google gets a little concerned, because if you let that go on too long, Google loses the right to sue anybody that says Google.
That's so tricky, because on the one hand, it's they own it. It's so ubiquitous, and they're the one that gets mentioned over and over. But pretty soon, it doesn't have the value that it had.
Right, and it's a brand's worst nightmare. You know, if you can't if you have to walk this line where you want the product and the name out there as much as possible so that it's on the tip of everybody's tongues, but you know, you go a little too far, you don't maintain that control well enough, and you do see these examples where, you know, brands have lost control of their brand.
An email from Tom says, fascinating how many callers say they are unaffected by brand when clearly the premise of the author is that they cannot avoid it even if they don't care about brands. I suspect this disconnect explains why branding works so well. What do you think about that?
Sure, absolutely. When you talk to consumers, and this has been true even in the reviews of the book, journalists have reviewed the book, most would prefer to believe, and like myself, that we're just not affected by this. But when you're seeing 3,000 to 5,000 advertisements a day, and when they're coming at us with the background and understanding of neuromarketing that they're getting into now, and the kind of psychological analysis they're getting into now about how we digest information, I think your listeners, if they take a closer look at neuromarketing in those fields, they'll see that brands are getting clever. And as much as we really think that we're kind of gaining the upper hand, maybe with social media and able to kind of leave reviews on Amazon about products, brands are reading those reviews too, and they're learning, and they're figuring out how to get around our mental filters to those buy buttons in the brain, as they like to call them, to kind of trigger the emotions that act so much faster than reason.
One thing I thought was interesting about the neuromarketing is the idea that people who were sort of given a Coke or shown the logo of Coke responded more strongly to the logo than even the taste of the product.
This is a fascinating study. Yeah, this is a study that was done about a decade ago now, and this just shows you how far neuromarketing is coming now. But they looked at folks who drank Coke and drank Pepsi and basically did the classic Pepsi challenge. And what they found in the first pass was that more of the participants liked Pepsi. Now, when they did the second pass, they didn't do a blind taste test. They actually put the brand label out there before they tasted the product. And they watched the brain scans while they went through the process. And what they found with the participants was now many of them switched over, seeing that they liked Coke more and that Coke was their preferred brand. And so the entire shift happened when they saw the label. And as they studied the brain scans, they realized that the front of the brain, which is this area that kind of controls our sense of identity, controls our sense of kind of memory and personal experience, was lighting up with activity. And that Coke, with its kind of ubiquitous marketing machine, when you look around, it's there when we're kids, it's there in the summer, it's there in the winter, it's there at every sport and every type of event. It's one of the largest advertisers in the world and regularly ranked as the top brand in the world. Coke has figured out that media environment it creates also creates a sense of kind of personal connection with its consumers.
Lucas Conley's book is called Obsessive Branding Disorder, The Illusion of Business and the Business of Illusion. Lucas, it really is a fascinating topic. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Hey, I appreciate it, and thanks for all those great questions.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.